lot of you listening out there. Way to go.
You made it through.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From the Pacifica Radio Network, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in Santa Barbara on 98.7 FM, San Diego's 93.7, and Ridgecrest and China Lake, California's 99.5 FM. Also in California on KFOI in Red Bluff and Redding and KKRN in Round Mountain. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, up in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. We were out of town all weekend. Was there any news of note in Southern California, Desi Doyen?
I think there was a little.
Did we miss any? What?
Yes, there was. Quite a bit, actually.
In fact, we were and are out of town, as luck or coincidence would have it. As I believe I had mentioned in passing a couple of weeks ago, some construction is being done on the roof of the building that houses our studio, and it's going to be ongoing for like 2 weeks or more, so we are told, which will make it impossible to work out of there. So we bugged out to another state for a bit, barely missing the storm as it rolled in, and we rolled out on our long ago, apparently well-timed, pre-scheduled bug out. That's both good and bad, as Hurricane Hillary and the earthquake that accompanied it, naturally, were both stories that I'd like to have been there for, frankly, but I wasn't. And in any event, thanks to all of those who sent us well wishes via email to bradcast@bradblog.com and on Twitter and elsewhere at TheBradBlog. We are doing fine. Well, I am. I don't know. Desi's a little shook up. But we survived the storm and, frankly, hardly even noticed it. But there was certainly something to notice, as you may have noticed. Quote, we basically blew all of our previous rainfall records out of the water, National Weather Service meteorologist Elizabeth Adams in San Diego told AP. In Palm Springs, for example, the inundation from a downgraded Hurricane Hillary shattered the daily record of 0.21 inches of rain set in 2003. That's the record, 0.21 inches of rain. On Sunday in Palm Springs, they got 3.18 inches of rain in one single day. The center of Hillary passed over downtown Los Angeles at 7 p.m. on Sunday night, according to the Regional Weather Office, which called it, quote, a day for the ages in Southern California, which, of course, is what I was so concerned about when I covered then Hurricane Hillary in such detail on last Thursday's show, when it seemed that no one else had really seemed to notice it at that point.
Yeah, it spun up very fast.
It did, and what it was, you know, happening, where it was most likely headed. And then I kind of went to bed that night wondering, oh God, did I spend too much time covering that story, only to wake up on Friday and see that everyone had noticed it by
yes.
then and was covering it. So we got a bit of a jump on that. Good. Hopefully that all helped people keep people safe. No significant injuries have been reported from the storm, at least in Los Angeles. Areas of the desert outside of L.A. were not and are not quite as lucky. But L.A. City Council President Paul Krikorian told a news conference on Monday that, quote, Los Angeles was tested, but we came through with minimal impacts considering what we endured. Desi, you've got some more today on that news conference on Monday morning with members of the City Council, as well as L.A. Mayor Karen Bass.
Yes, and also L.A. Fire Department and other agency officials who were in charge of the emergency response. So at that press conference on Monday morning, L.A. Mayor Karen Bass delivered an update on the emergency response to the storm. She praised the city's coordinated interagency emergency response system and the preparation and dedication of all the first responders and the Angelenos, she said, for heeding all of the officials' warnings and preparing for the storm and helping each other throughout.
This was a coordinated, collaborative approach, and reports thus far indicate that as of right now, there have not been any deaths or significant risk of injury. The city mobilized, including opening the most emergency temporary shelters for unhoused Angelenos to provide relief from extreme weather since 2020, and we will continue to address these issues. Now, it's not to say that many Angelenos have not been impacted by this storm, whether they woke up without power or were unable to get through streets due to flooding and mudslides. Our commitment to you is that we will approach our recovery with the same intensity as we approached our preparation. As skies clear, the Department of Water and Power crews have already mobilized to return power to Angelenos. If you approach a traffic signal that is not operational, treat it as a stop sign. If a traffic officer is at the location, heed their instructions. Crews are working to bring these signals back online as we speak. As you know, sometimes damage can occur in the hours and days after a storm hits, so Angelenos should continue to stay vigilant. The city family will continue working around the clock to respond, and we will need your help. You pull everybody together, you prepare for the worst, and you hope for the best. And so the fact that it wasn't the catastrophe that had been anticipated, we are very happy about. But had it been, I have the full confidence that our city family was prepared to respond.
Now, beyond that, L.A. City Fire Department Chief Kristen Crowley said that the impacts from the remnants of Tropical Storm Hillary are ongoing. And on Monday, officials asked folks to please stay off the roads unless absolutely necessary to give space for power and street repair crews and first responders to do their jobs. Fire Chief Crowley also warned that saturated hillsides still pose a threat of landslides, as do trees and power lines that are still vulnerable and could still topple. And they say if you've got to travel, then please be extra careful on the roads and slow down because some road closures are still in effect. So you got to check local conditions. And as we go to air, the biggest impacts, as you say, appear to have been in the high desert areas, especially Palm Springs Valley. 911 service was knocked out. Interstate 10 was closed in both directions. That's going to be ongoing until they're able to clean it up. And the fire chief of Cathedral City, which is near Palm Springs, says it'll take time for floodwaters to recede and crews to clear the mudslides and debris from the roads. And about 150 miles of Highway 395 on the eastern side of the Sierra Nevada mountains up through Bishop has been closed. 150 miles of that. So make
sure. One of my favorite roads, by the way.
Yeah, it's a beautiful road. It's closed right now.
Yep.
Schools in the LA Unified District School District were closed Monday, and they will reopen for regular school on Tuesday. And officials also reminded folks to please stay out of the ocean. Storm stormwater drains in LA and Ventura counties dump directly into the ocean, and that stormwater is contaminated with a toxic stew of dangerous bacteria and chemicals and trash and God knows what all.
Yeah.
So they say to wait 72 hours before venturing into the water.
Speaking of Palm Springs, the Palm Springs PD, in that statement about 911 lines being down, they said that in the event of an emergency, residents should text 911 or reach out to the nearest police or fire station. Yeesh, good luck texting 911. That's kind of scary. Nonetheless, as skies were clearing on Monday, at least in California, the National Weather Service warned of flooding underway in parts of Clark County in Nevada, about 40 miles west of Las Vegas. Forecasters said the threat for flooding in states farther north on Monday was highest across much of southeastern Oregon. Hello, Oregon, pay attention. And into the west central mountains of Idaho. Meanwhile, over in the Caribbean, Tropical Storm Franklin churned on Monday near Haiti and the Dominican Republic, where authorities warned residents to prepare for floods and landslides. Forecasters at the National Hurricane Center are also watching a disturbance in the Gulf of Mexico that has now an 80% chance of developing into a tropical disturbance or tropical storm before reaching the western Gulf coastline on Tuesday. Forecasters urge people along the coast in northern Mexico and Texas to monitor the system, adding that tropical storm watches or warnings may soon be issued. Oh, and then there are another three or so storms lined up behind all of that, coming off the coast of Africa and headed this way, as the Atlantic storm season suddenly kicks into high gear. But out west, a tropical storm last roared into California way back in September of 1939. At that time, it ripped apart train tracks. It tore houses from their foundations. It capsized many boats. Nearly 100 people were killed on both land and at sea. This time, thankfully, we were a little bit more prepared. But how much do we need to prepare for these kind of storms in the future out here in the West as the oceans continue to warm, more moisture gets stored in warming air, and as weather patterns themselves may be changing? All thanks to, yes, man-made climate change. We've got just the person standing by who knows the answers to all of those questions as much as they can be known, and many other questions as well. Let's take a quick break here, and we'll be joined by Dr. Daniel Swain, climate scientist at UCLA and researcher at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and the Nature Conservancy of California. That's straight ahead, along with a bit more news today. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. If you haven't noticed by now, it's no easy feat finding facts, real facts, not alternative facts, over your public airwaves. We try to bring you real facts, truth, and clarity without fear or favor each and every day on the Bradcast. But we need your help to do it. If you enjoy the show and or get something from it, please give back a bit if you can by visiting us at bradblog.com/donate. Your support helps Desi and me continue to bring you real, independent, progressive news 5 days a week over your public airwaves. We simply can't do it without your help, and that help is needed more now than ever. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate today to make a one-time donation, or even better, automated monthly support. It'll take you about 60 seconds, and you can rest easy knowing that we'll be here every day making sense of it all, or at least trying to. That's bradblog.com/donate, and thanks.
Seems it never rains in Southern California.
Ah, yes, the irony is thick thick as the unusually tropical humidity for some reason in the Southwest today, from California to Nevada to Arizona. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. California, of course, rarely sees landfalling tropical cyclones or hurricanes, with 1939 being the last time that such an event reportedly occurred in the Golden State. The only other known tropical cyclone to actually make coastal landfall in California was the 1858 San Diego hurricane, according to Weather West's Dr. Daniel Swain. That was all long before our storm naming system, even before the modern National Weather Service came into being. It was in no small part due to that 1939 storm, which caught the state completely unaware, which actually helped lead to the formation of the Weather Service's critical national warning system and the National Hurricane Center. But tropical storm and then hurricane and then post-tropical cyclone Hillary made history over the past several days, spinning up virtually out of nowhere from tropical storm to major Category 4 hurricane in just 24 hours before breaking all the rules and heading north into California rather than out west toward Hawaii, which is more typical for storms in the eastern Pacific. While most folks don't think about hurricanes in the Pacific, at least not on the west coast, we've seen a very busy Pacific storm season so far this year. Whether you previously heard about it or not, it was, in fact, one of those major Pacific storms, Hurricane Dora, which blew by Hawaii hundreds of miles to the south a little over a week ago, but whose major wind gusts on its outer bands, in fact, helped quickly intensify the horrific and deadly wildfires on Maui. So are the record wildfires and storms and flooding and warming oceans and intense heat, etc., that we have seen week after week, month after month this summer in the U.S. and elsewhere around the globe, a preview, a template for our climate-changed future? Or is that future here now? Or is the confluence of extreme weather events in recent months simply a coincidence, a string of bad luck? Joining us now with a few answers for a number of my dumb questions on that and much more is Dr. Daniel Swain. He is climate scientist in the Institute of Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. He also holds concurrent appointments as a research fellow at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and as the California Climate Fellow at the Nature Conservancy of California. He holds a PhD in Earth System Science from Stanford University, focusing on changing character, causes, and impacts of extreme weather and climate events on a warming planet. What warming planet? Dr. Swain, welcome to the broadcast, sir, and thank you for joining us on what I know is an insane day for folks like yourself. At least I'm hoping it is insane, frankly. I'm hoping the mainstream corporate media is finally ringing your phone off the hook at this point. Daniel?
Yes, well, this week in particular has been rather crazy, but actually the whole summer has been, because it would be one thing if this was just the singular extreme event that everyone was interested in this year, but no, there have just been an almost uncountable number of them around the world this summer.
Yeah, week after week, day after, it's been amazing. We've been doing our best to cover them, but it is impossible to keep up. So I'm just curious, before we get into some of that, Dr. Swain, after all of these years studying our climate crisis and all the related phenomenon, was Hillary the first hurricane or tropical storm in this case that you personally experienced where you lived?
Well, so this was actually one event I also experienced from afar, since these days I'm physically located in Boulder, Colorado. You mentioned that National Center for Atmospheric Science research appointment. That's where it is located in Boulder. But yes, I mean, there, you know, these sorts of events with actual intact tropical cyclones being located anywhere over California are very rare historically. Uh-huh. And the last time one a such system actually made landfall in California And landfall actually means it has to come in from the ocean side. So it can't sneak in from the south over the deserts through the mountains. But it has to come in from the coast side of California. That would have been 1939, as you mentioned. So that's a long time ago. And there have been other systems at or near tropical storm strength that have sort of come in the back door over land and affected Southern California with some heavy rainfall over the years. But to be clear, any of those sorts of events are rare. And so this is definitely, you know, a historical event that we saw unfold this past weekend in Southern California.
I'll say, and how did, I know you're, well, you're in Boulder, where you guys have had your own share of extreme weather in recent years. What is your understanding how LA did, how Southern California did, San Diego, and those areas that had at least a few days heads up to handle this otherwise wildly rare event? What's your sense of how the area fared this extreme weather?
Well, I think your mileage may vary considerably depending on specifically where you were in Southern California. So ironically, despite the fact that this tropical storm came very close to actually being directly overhead San Diego and Los Angeles, these were not the parts of Southern California that were most severely affected, nor were they expected to be. So the interesting part about the sort of the media headlines leading up to the event and some of the discourse on social media was there were a lot of people who were very concerned about what was going to happen in downtown LA and the beaches of Orange County and sort of this urban corridor right along the coast. Even though the likelihood there was that this would have been, you know, a remarkable event with some heavy rain and probably some strong winds and some urban flooding and some modest wind damage, like trees down, power outages, kind of things like that, which is essentially what ended up happening in those areas. But that the real concern, the real use of that kind of alarming language from the Weather Service and from commentators like myself, was regarding the flood risk in the mountains and deserts, which was quite extreme. And some of that really did materialize. In fact, we're only now just starting to get some information and images on just how big the floods were. But most of the highways and interstates in that part of the state are shut down because they were either covered by floodwaters, mud flows, or were washed out entirely in some places. So the road is not there anymore. And there were quite a lot of evacuations up along the Highway 395 corridor, along I-10 in the desert, and in up by Big Bear in the transverse ranges, the San Gregorio Mountains, etc. So, you know, big debris flows, big flash floods, mostly in the places that we thought they would be most likely. And some flooding, you know, there's images of Melrose in LA under a couple feet of water. So that's notable for sure. But largely, I think this played out pretty close to forecasts. You know, this was something that was pretty well predicted.
It does seem as if it was. Now, as Hillary was rolling in, you noted at your Weather West blog that its fast forward speed and intensity meant that the storm would not have time to completely spin down after making landfall and before it reached Southern California because it was moving so quickly. Not the wind speed, but the speed of the entire storm. Is that in fact what did end up happening? And isn't the fast forward speed, on the other hand, one of the things that actually made the storm perhaps less bad, unlike Hurricane Harvey comes to mind in Houston, which was a very slow moving storm and just drenched the same area for days on end because it wouldn't move on?
Yeah, I think there's some interesting things to talk about here because the situation, of course, along the West Coast, the Pacific Coast of North America, is very different than the situation in the Gulf of Mexico or even along the Eastern Seaboard. There's really three key things that prevent tropical storms or hurricanes from affecting California more often. It has happened, you know, a handful of times, but literally something you could count on one hand in the last century now, even after Hillary. And the reason why that's the case is that even though Southern California has a latitude similar to that of, say, the South Carolina, which is a much warmer, more humid place, and as you know, the Carolinas are quite susceptible to hurricane landfalls. Cape Hatteras is one of the most hurricane landfalls of any place on Earth over the years. So why do they see so many more on the same at the same latitude in the Atlantic basin than we do here on the West Coast, the Pacific basin? Well, there's, you know, as I mentioned, there's three key reasons. The most obvious one is the ocean here is a lot colder. Warm tropical ocean waters are hurricane fuel. And if it's too cool, you don't have any of that hurricane fuel. It's an empty gas tank for storms that manage to get close to California. The second reason is that you tend to have prevailing easterly winds in the tropics, meaning winds that blow from east to west, and as you mentioned earlier, push those storms in the Pacific basin westward out to the open ocean towards Hawaii. Of course, in the Atlantic, if you push storms westward from the Atlantic, you're pushing them towards the continent, toward the east coast into the Gulf of Mexico. And then that last factor, that third factor that keeps those kind of storms away from California most of the time, is the fact we just have a really hostile atmosphere for tropical cyclones. It's too dry, it's too stable, so you have no fuel, since the oceans aren't warm enough. The winds usually push the storms away, and then anything that does make it here gets clobbered by the atmosphere, which just wants to sort of dissipate those storms. What happened this time is those easterly winds that normally keep those storms out over the open ocean weren't present, and we had a very rare combination of very strong, record-breaking high pressure over the center of the continent, a low pressure to the west of California, and that sort of acted as a funnel to draw this storm up northward directly over Southern California. So that combined with some unusually warm ocean temperatures off the coast of Mexico allowed this very unusual event to unfold.
Well, it's obviously unusual now. I'm wondering how unusual it will be in the future. E&E's ClimateWire reports that, as you note, Dr. Swain, the most important factor in this storm as it moved up north into the U.S. versus out to sea, as would normally be expected with storms like this, is that the region's typical easterly winds have temporarily vanished. Now, we've spoken on this program with Dr. Michael Mann and others a number of times about changes that we're beginning to see in actual global climate and weather patterns thanks to climate change. Are we sure that the disappearance of those easterly winds that normally sort of protect the East Coast, are we sure that that is temporary, and why would they disappear in the first place this year?
Well, to be clear, they haven't disappeared this whole year. This is just there's just a few days where they're not present over the eastern Pacific. So just a long enough window for this storm to sneak northward. So let me break this down a bit.
Yeah.
There's sort of three pieces in terms of the climate change connection question here. One is the question of, well, first of all, I think the most important piece and also the clearest answer, so I'll start with that one, is this was fundamentally an extreme precipitation event. So yes, it was windy, but it, you know, there was no catastrophic wind damage. It was within the range of winds we see every couple of years in Southern California. The big deal was this extreme summer rainfall event associated with this tropical storm. That's where most of the damages have come from, and that's been true in the past as well. When we have seen these tropical events in California in the sort of the off season, it's the rainfall that gets us, and the flooding in the mountains and the deserts and things like that. And we know in a warming climate that the likelihood and the intensity of extreme precipitation events goes up very quickly, in fact, exponentially with warming. So this is something people talk about breaking points and tipping points and thresholds and exponential growth. One of the things that truly is exponential in the warming climate is the atmosphere's capacity to hold water vapor. And this, in turns out, gets us into trouble in two dimensions. One, when it's dry, that atmosphere is thirstier and it tends to extract water from the landscape more quickly. That's a problem for droughts and wildfires on the one hand, but in the present instance where we have a strong, rare tropical storm over Southern California in August, what it means is that we have an increased ability of the atmosphere to produce extreme precipitation. So the ceiling on how intense precipitation can become rises by around 7% per degree centigrade of warming, or 7% per degree and a half or so Fahrenheit of warming. And that's an exponential process. It's like interest in the money in the bank, although very few of us get to benefit from 7% interest in a checking account. But that's what the atmosphere is doing when it comes to water vapor. And so from the perspective of an extreme precipitation event, we shattered a lot of rainfall records yesterday all across Southern California for the summer months. We saw the moistest air mass, so the air mass with the most moisture in it, ever observed at some locations in Southern California and Southern Nevada. And we know with great certainty the likelihood of seeing extreme precipitation events, whether or not they're associated with tropical cyclones, is going up in a warming world. So that's piece one. Mm-hmm. The second piece here has to do with the track itself. As you mentioned, there are a few historical instances of tracks like this, but not very many. You can count them on one hand. So this was definitely a rare event. And the fact that this sort of went right up the coast between San Diego and LA and ended up inland in California as a tropical storm, I think this is the northwesternmost tropical storm I think we've observed in California history. So that definitely is a historic moment there. The answer there, though, in terms of climate change is a little bit less clear. We don't know yet if California will become somewhat more susceptible to events like this. But let me speculate. The reason why I'm speculating is no one's really done the research on this yet. There are really no studies to point to.
Because it's so rare and unusual that nobody's really looking at it?
It's kind of sufficiently an edge case that I just don't think anybody has looked at this. But here's my thinking. Yeah. So going on a little bit on a limb as a meteorologist and climate scientist, I mentioned those three barriers, to the three reasons why California doesn't really see more tropical storm activity. The ocean's too cold, you have those easterly winds, which essentially direct storms out to sea, and the atmosphere dislikes to shred storms. It's too dry and too stable. Mm-hmm. Of those three barriers, there's one that's clearly going to weaken a bit in a warming climate, and that's the fact that the oceans are going to get warmer. Mm-hmm. Now, there's essentially a 0% chance we're ever going to see a strengthening hurricane off the Santa Monica Pier or something. The oceans just aren't anywhere near as warm as they'd need to be, so even if the few degrees warmer, they're still not warm enough for that. However, you know, as you mentioned, one of the things that happened this week was that Hurricane Hilary, at its peak, rapidly intensified from a tropical storm into a very powerful hurricane. Category 4 on, again, the scale only goes to 5, so that's 4 out of 5. Very intense hurricane over the open ocean to the west of Mexico. That ocean was between 2 and 4 degrees centigrade warmer than it usually was. That's a large, so that's like, you know, 5, 6 plus degrees Fahrenheit warmer than usual. That's a big jump in ocean temperatures in that region. That probably helped Hilary intensify as rapidly as it did, because again, those warm oceans are hurricane fuel. And so if the ocean temperatures in these formation regions are more conducive to having these rapidly intensifying hurricanes that attain category 4 or 5 status, it means that if we ever do get these unusual wind patterns that we have right now, that draw these storms northward over California, which again is rare but not unheard of, they're going to be more likely to reach here potentially at tropical storm strength or greater, simply because, not because they're intensifying as they come near the coast, but instead they're weakening less quickly potentially than they used to, which might increase the likelihood of seeing events like this. So that is me, again, going out on a limb a little bit, but the one thing that clearly will change is the oceans are warming.
Yeah.
And we don't know necessarily if these wind patterns will change in a way that might favor it as well. That's sort of a secondary hypothesis. And I know you mentioned Mike Mann's work on this. You know, there is a record-breaking high-pressure system over the center of the continent right now. That is a major player here. And there are some hypotheses that, at least in the summer months in the Northern Hemisphere, that certain things that are happening with the jet stream might make the persistence of those kinds of big massive heat domes that get stuck in place during the summer months more common. That's sort of at the cutting edge of climate science. You know, some of Michael Mann's own work suggests this, and there is some supporting evidence, but you know, there are other studies that are a little more equivocal. So we don't know yet so much about those winds, but let me say this. If that ends up being correct, it's going to be a pretty big deal, not just for this edge case of tropical storms in California. It might affect those for sure, but it's really going to affect the massive summer heat waves and, you know, that we've been seeing more and more of in recent years. And, you know, this year has not been a particularly hot year in California, thankfully, but it has been almost everywhere else in the world. California has been kind of a big outlier in that sense. So, you know, there's just a lot going on this year, and there are definitely links to climate change with much of it. Some of them are a little bit more equivocal than others. But I think, you know, we're all living in the context of a changed climate.
It is, though, it is that changing or possibly changing jet stream that Michael Mann talks about, that, as you said, there is 0 degree chance of a hurricane forming off of the Santa Monica Pier. I've written that down, Dr. Daniel Swain, August, whatever we are, of 2023, because, boy, I hope you're right. I hope things don't change that much that that could happen. But at this point, seems like anything could happen of late. There are, in the meantime, about 4 storms, 4, maybe 5, depending on how you count them, lined up across the Atlantic heading this way from Africa. Should we be concerned about those? And will the increased El Nino wind shear that tends to decrease storms in the Pacific, whereas I think it the wind shear decreases, I'm sorry, in the Atlantic, whereas it decreases in the Pacific. So will that change in the wind shear play a role in helping to break up those 4 storms headed this way? Or do we need to be concerned as they get closer to the continental U.S.?
Well, I guess it depends a little bit on who we is in this context. Does California need to worry about them? No.
I agree on that one. Yeah.
But there's folks, you know, in the Caribbean or in the Gulf of Mexico or the Eastern Seaboard. Yeah. That's a different question. And, you know, these it's a little too early to know. You know, these are all storms that have yet to form. The Hurricane Center has highlighted quite the map of their potential storm development regions in the Atlantic right now. It looks like I don't know exactly what the right analogy would be, but there's a lot of regions. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of potential storms forming. The conga line of potential hurricanes, right, if you will, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting closer to the peak of Atlantic hurricane season. Usually that happens in September. So it peaks late, and we're getting closer. So we're going to be nicely into late August, early September for these storms. And that's right when you'd expect it to be. What's going on this year, of course, is, well, we have 2 big things happening. One is a strong El Nino event is developing, mm-hmm. not just any old El Nino, but a particularly strong one appears to be well underway now. That does usually tend to suppress the Atlantic hurricane season, as you mentioned, because of increased vertical wind shear, which is unfavorable. It tends to tear tropical storms and hurricanes apart. However, this year, we also have record warm ocean temperatures. So remember that interaction between the climate change component and these natural variations. El Nino is essentially a natural variation, uh-huh. but of course the long-term warming trend of the oceans is not. That is climate change. The problem is this year is kind of confounded seasonal predictions for Atlantic hurricanes, because on the one hand, El Nino should, you know, induce this wind shear to tear storms apart. But on the other hand, there is a much larger reservoir of potential hurricane fuel available than ever before in the Atlantic. So if any of those storms can sneak through and not get torn apart by the shear, then watch out, because they have a greater than usual likelihood of being strong storms. So right now, the oceans are still warmer than average, and it looks like the shear for the next week or so is apparently low enough that we might see some storm development.
Oh,
so
boy.
So it's a bit of a mixed picture, but it just points to the complication of making some of these predictions in a warming climate where, you know, we've never had the combination of record warm oceans plus mm-hmm. very strong developing El Nino event in recorded history.
Dr. Daniel Swain, I know I got to let you go here, but let me see if I can fit in 1 or 2 more very quickly. This summer has been just insane as far as the climate goes. Major storms, flooding from the U.S. Northeast to now the U.S. Southwest to China and Europe, following on back-to-back atmospheric, you know, river storms out here in California in the spring. Record heat across much of the South, U.S. South, parts of the West Coast, horrific record wildfires across all of Canada, pretty much. And of course, now out on Maui, and of course, hot tub like ocean temperatures that you're talking about off the coast of Florida and so forth, just to name a few events in recent weeks this summer. You know, we've been hearing quite a bit from scientists over the past months, really a year, maybe past several years, in fact, that the climate crisis is so far shaping up to be worse than previously predicted as far as how quickly it is getting worse. Where are we on that scale for you as you see it in your work? Is this about what you had predicted? Are we in worse shape at this point than you thought we would be? Better shape? Is there any way to quantify that?
I think there's two ways of looking at this, and it's worth quickly exploring both. One is that if the question is, has the Earth warmed more than we thought it would by this point, then the answer is no. In fact, we're right exactly, almost to the nose on the dot of the median of predictions about how much the Earth would have warmed by circa 2023. So the good news is we're not warming dramatically more than we thought we would, which means that for better or for worse, you know, our predictions, at least about global temperature, are largely on target. However, that's sort of where the good news ends, because I think it is fair to say that the impacts of the warming that we have seen, even though that warming is roughly in line with what we thought we'd see by this point, have been worse, I think, than had been predicted. And that extends to the impacts of increasing extreme weather events in many cases. I think we did historically underestimate the degree to which that was going to disrupt ecosystems, ecologies, and human systems, cities, populations all around the world. So, you know, one of the reasons for that, I think, is that we, you know, humans tend to think in linear terms. And the thing is, the warming itself, the planetary warming, the 1.3 or 1.4 degrees Celsius or so of global mean warming we've seen so far, has largely been linear. But a lot of the atmospheric processes that are relevant to extremes, that water vapor holding capacity of the atmosphere I mentioned, which is an exponential increase with linear warming, that is driving a lot of the impacts, the droughts, the floods, the wildfires. And so in that sense, this linear warming, we know scientifically, just from the way physics and thermodynamics work, we've known this for over a century, that part of the process would be exponential. But I'm just not fully sure we had come to terms with what that actually meant for extreme events and for the world that we live in. And so I think that is a fair statement, as long as we're talking about the impacts of climate change that we've observed and extreme events in particular. So no, we're not seeing more warming. We're not seeing, you know, I see folks worried that we're seeing runaway warming or something. That isn't happening, and yet I don't personally or professionally find that very reassuring, given that we're continuing to warm on this roughly linear track. But even if it stays relatively linear, the impacts won't be
right.
And we're starting to see things, you know, the limits of our adaptability already, and it's only going to get harder with additional warming, because these processes, again, the fact that the water vapor holding capacity of the atmosphere is exponential with warming means that the next degree of warming is going to bring about bigger changes than the last degree.
So saying it's not worse than we thought is not necessarily a very encouraging thing at this point. Dr. Daniel Swain, climate scientist at the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at the University of California in L.A. He's also working at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and as a climate fellow at the Nature Conservancy of California. You can and should follow his blog at weatherwest.com. You can find him on the Twitters at weather_west. And though we didn't have time to talk about it this time, maybe next time he's kind enough to join us, we can discuss his extreme weather and climate page a day calendar, which is now available for 2024 at a discount, which is right since we're, you know, more than halfway through, but still filled with all sorts of important information. Dr. Daniel Swain, greatly appreciate you joining us on this very busy day. We'll try to call you on a less busy day next time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. A lot of information there.
Oh, yes.
A dense conversation in a good way, I think.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask him about the earthquake.
I know.
We had a friend who contacted us from out of town as the storm was rolling in, and he said, be careful about earthquakes. And I'm not sure why that is. I think his suggestion was the water in the aquifers refills.
I'm not exactly sure what the mechanism is behind that that concept. I mean, I've heard other people have mentioned it as well, but I don't understand how that would actually work. And if it didn't happen during the winter storms that we had and earthquakes,
we had huge rain. Right. Yeah, you wouldn't think it would happen now. And yet, about an hour into the storm, the storm was barely even on shore. Suddenly we get a 5.1 earthquake in Ojai. I should note, as I understand, there was no great damage. There was a lot of aftershocks and foreshocks.
Right, but the but apparently officials say that there were no major injuries or casualties or major damage that was from that. But it was just the hurricane, I think.
The hurricane was what everybody used. But yeah, when that came in, because I, you know, when he originally said, hey, be careful, there could be an earthquake, I was like, yeah, whatever, shut up. And then an hour in, 5.1 earthquake.
I know. It seemed like it was everything everywhere all at once. Way too much. But yep. I think one thing that the earthquake happening in the middle of an historic storm that, you know, hasn't happened in, what, 80-something years, mm-hmm. that is a sign of how we really need to make sure that we are prepared for not just one disaster happening, but multiple disasters happening at the same time. You know, that's the biggest takeaway for me from all of this, that preparation and
it's
planning
like
matter.
It's like you're rooting for more than one disaster at the same time.
No, I'm not. I really am not. But I am rooting for preparation because I think that was the big message that came out of the press conference today, which was, you know, yeah, it wasn't as bad as it could have been. We made it through just fine on what we received so far in LA County and LA City, but that, you know, that kind of preparation, that kind of interagency coordination where they were coordinated at the local level, the county level, the state level, and the federal government level is also sending in help and FEMA, you know, an emergency designation and all of that to release more funding and more materials to be able to mount this emergency response and the long-term rebuilding process for people that have had damages and add damages to our infrastructure as well.
And I got to say, speaking of infrastructure, going back through, Jerry Brown's terms of office, California was doing a lot of building, a lot of infrastructure improvements, building, shoring up dams, building reservoirs.
Reservoirs, water catchment, groundwater recharge to help store all that water.
Correct. And because back when they were doing it, we were in the middle of a multi-year drought, and I was seeing all of this building going on for all of these reservoirs, thinking, boy, talk about wishful thinking. But sure enough, I'm glad those are in place. I don't even know if they're all done. There was so much of that building going on, but I know a lot of them are done, and I suspect that made a big difference, not just with the winter storms or the spring storms that we had, one atmospheric river after another, but then Hurricane Hillary blows into town. So yeah, it's a good idea to invest in infrastructure, it seems.
It is indeed. And I think that it also shows how we really do need to invest, not just, you know, in these bursts of funding, but we need to invest over time in maintenance. A lot of deferred maintenance, not just in California, but around the country. You know, we have deteriorating roads and bridges. Those things are being slowly addressed, you know, through federal funding from the Infrastructure Reduction Act and other
The Bipartisan Infrastructure Act and the Inflation Reduction
Act. That's what I was
meaning.
Thank
you.
That's
combine them
say,
and
did.
Gave them both a better name, to be frank.
That's true. But I think it does show that we really do have to prepare now and build for the 21st century extremes that we are going to be seeing. Because our infrastructure was built for the average weather, the average climate of the 20th century, and we are no longer in that climate right now. We have to build for the extremes that are coming now in the 21st century, because basically this is what 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels looks like. We're not there permanently
right
now.
This is what we've been trying to avoid through the Paris Treaty and all of that.
And that's the target to avoid going above that permanently. Where this year is probably going to be an incursion to give us a preview of what that's going to look like. And it, I think, is pretty scary. And it shows we really need to get to work on cutting emissions and building up infrastructure resilience.
And speaking of two more than one disaster at once, given that the storm out here in the West sucked up much of the media attention, understandably, over the last couple of days, I want to make sure that we don't forget about Hawaii, where the county's mayor offered a somewhat grim update to start the week. Actually, tried to put a bit of a smile on this otherwise grim news. A total now of 850 people are still missing in connection with the deadly wildfires that devastated Maui just over a week ago. In an overnight update posted to Facebook, Maui County Mayor Richard Bisson said there were now 850 people officially believed to be missing. He also noted at least 114 people now are confirmed to have died in the wildfires, the deadliest in modern U.S. history. Bisson said the number of missing people was the result of the FBI combining and refining various lists of missing people. He added, "We are, quote, we are both saddened and relieved about these numbers." He says there's positive news in this number. Explaining, quote, because when this process began, the missing person list contained over 2,000 names, but that more than 1,285 people have been located safe. While the number of people initially feared missing was more than 2,000, as Bisson noted, it dropped as cell phone communications were restored and people were able to make contact with their loved ones. But, boy, it's hard to get too excited about 850 still missing people. Arriving at an accurate count, a death count, in mass casualty disasters apparently can, well, we've seen this before. It can take months or even years, if ever. According to researchers and forensic anthropologists, Lynn Goodman, an epidemiologist at George Washington University, said that they are still trying to take stock of who was in the area during the fire and therefore who are missing. Goldman studied the death toll after Hurricane Maria struck Puerto Rico back in 2017, where we had really bad, really unreliable numbers and have them to this day. She notes the death toll number is always provisional in a way. She says, I assume people won't stop trying to find remains and the work will take a very, very long time. On Friday, the FBI announced the opening of a site where people could provide DNA samples that would be matched with the remains that they have already been found in a bid to help expedite the process of identifying victims. So we'll continue to keep our eyes on that. It is yet another dark day on Maui, no matter how much the mayor tries to spin it positively, and I certainly understand his need to do so. But so dark day on Maui. Much of the Southwest continues to hold its breath still. That flooding will not get too far out of control from the massive amount of moisture in the air from Hurricane Hillary, Tropical Storm Hillary, then Hurricane Hillary, then post-tropical cyclone Hillary.
Right.
Still watching for flooding and mudslides, but that's our world, I guess, in mid to late August 2023. I suspect we will be back to politics. And now, actually, I'm thinking to myself, hopefully we're back to politics tomorrow.
Right, because it's much more interesting, I think, for me to talk about politics than to talk about disasters. I would prefer there aren't any more extreme weather disasters.
It's
in this
interesting
country.
For me to talk about disasters, but it's a little too interesting. I don't need to be that interested, frankly. We'll see. Hopefully politics will return tomorrow to the broadcast, but we will see.
There's also a Republican debate coming up as well.
Exactly. We got our first GOP presidential debate coming up this week, and Donald Trump made clear over the weekend that he is too much of a coward to show up for it.
He
ain't coming, he says, and he suggested he wouldn't come to any of the other primary Republican primary debates either, because did I mention he's a coward? And just before airtime, the news broke that Trump's attorneys and law enforcement apparently struck an agreement with officials in Fulton County, Georgia. They have agreed to a $200,000 bond for the former president and some other conditions for his post-surrender release in his fourth felony indictment of the summer, as he remains the favorite candidate of a majority of Republican Party primary voters, according to all polling to date. Polling that hasn't really changed all that much, at least not as far as he is concerned, that even though he is now facing 91 criminal felony charges as he runs for a second term in office. And the Republicans think that's great, at least the Republicans who vote in the primaries, at least the Republicans who vote in the primaries, who speak to pollsters. I'm really hoping there are still some Republicans left out there
who are willing to vote in the primaries,
who are not going to vote for this guy who is facing 91 criminal counts. That seems like a downside for a president of the United States, for a nominee for the party.
Seems like it should be a disqualifier, perhaps. And also, it'll be interesting to get to the Republican debate this week in Milwaukee to see if there are any questions about climate change, any questions about these extreme weather disasters we've been having. If the corporate media...
Of course there won't
be. It's on Fox News, so you're right.
Of course there won't. It's on, not only is it on Fox News, it's on Fox News and it's a bunch of Republicans. So of course there won't be. Maybe they'll throw in something about Hillary. Someone's going to make a bad Hillary joke. Like, you know, Hurricane Hillary rolled into California and destroyed 30,000 emails. That sort of thing. That's going to suffice for their talk about climate in the Republican presidential debate, missing Donald Trump and on Fox News. No, by the way, Donald Trump did not show up for that promised news conference at 11 a.m., Monday morning in Bedminster, New Jersey, as he had promised last week to reveal a, quote, large, complex, detailed, but irrefutable report on the, that was all caps, on the presidential election fraud which took place in Georgia that he had promised would be, quote, conclusive, and that would offer him, quote, complete exoneration. As it turns out, he changed his mind. Never mind about all of that exoneration and that report. I am starting to wonder if he has any such report at all. Too cynical? I don't know. Anyway, gotta get out. My thanks to Desi Doyen, our producer. Thanks to Wendell Handy back at KPFK Central. Thanks, Wendell. And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other that we have ever done in our lives, you can download it for free at bradblog.com. Oh, yes. Thanks to our guest, Dr. Daniel Swain of UCLA and the National Center for Atmospheric Research.
Yes, thank you, thanks. Dr. Swain.
Now I'm all confused. I'm completely out of order. You can download the show at bradblog.com. Ah, yes, you can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And you will find me on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site formerly known as Twitter, at The Brad Blog. We will see you there until we see you back here, hopefully tomorrow. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.